SIDPOD, episode 196, May 28th, 2010. No, really, it is, I checked. This week's story, The Hand You're Dealt, by Frank Orito. Hello, welcome to SIDPOD, the weekly horror podcast. I remain Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Frank Orito. Frank was here a little while back with regulars, and has a story in the Witherson anthology due out towards the end of this year. This piece is making its world debut here, and is read for us by Jesse Livingston. So check your hand, and then check your hand, because I have a story for you. I promise you it's true.
The Hand You're Dealt, by Frank Orito. Pain and nausea were a sea that Danny was convinced he would drown in. Rod might be a dumb thug, but the man knew how to hit a guy. He tried to inhale, but Rod's meaty fist was jammed in his gut, pinning him to the alley's graffiti-covered wall. The night's shadows seemed to deepen as Danny's vision dimmed. Rod released the pressure a bit. Danny sucked in air. Rod turned his hand over, hoisted Danny up by his belt, and slapped him hard across the face with his free hand. Danny would have admired the grace of it all if he hadn't been on the receiving end. "I need it all, Danny," Rod said conversationally, and lifted him a few inches up the wall. Danny's gut clenched as his inseam pressed into his balls. Rod had been a professional bodybuilder in the 80s. The sport declined and his age increased, so he turned into loan sharking and bookmaking. He was jowly now and had a beer paunch, but the strength was there and he liked showing it off. $12,000. You got it? Danny began to mumble. A swift, hard backhand cut off even that. It was a rhetorical question, asshole. You don't have it. But what does every cloud have? When no answer seemed forthcoming, he pulled Danny a bit higher into the air. He leaned into Danny's face and asked again louder, "What does every cloud have?"
"A silver lining,"
Danny answered around his swollen tongue.
"That's right, a silver lining."
Rod smiled and let Danny's feet touch the ground. "You see, I could use a good mechanic, Danny. You've done the job before. Same gig. There's still a few college boys out there looking to lose their tuition. The only difference is you'd be working for me. Come see me. We'll talk details. You know where to find me, and I know where to find you." Rod stepped back and let Danny slide to the ground. Danny felt a wad of papers land on his face. He knew it was the 300 he tried to give Rod a few minutes before. "Hold on to it. Maybe you'll find a game." Danny watched Rod's Allen Edmonds loafers grow more distant until they'd left the alley altogether. After resting a few moments, Danny pulled himself up onto his knees. He vomited carefully. This was his best suit. Taking as deep a breath as he could, he began to straighten himself out. Danny stepped from darkness onto the neon-lit sidewalk of East Carson Street. A steady stream of college students bar-hopped their way past, too intent on their pursuit of a good time to notice what might be happening in the shadowed side streets. Two doors down from the alley's mouth was Drake's Bar and Grill. Danny walked inside and made a beeline for the John.
"Jimmy, set me up a JD on ice," he called as he passed the balding man behind the bar.
"You okay, Danny?" the bartender asked, but Danny ignored him. In the bathroom, he did what he could with cold water and a comb and went back to the bar. He stared at the gold-flecked mirror behind the rows of flavored rums. There was a small cut over his left cheekbone, and his lip had obviously been split. The most painful parts of the beating, the blow to the gut, and biting his own goddamn tongue, still hurt but weren't noticeable. All in all, he might pass muster with Sharon. She was pulling 12-hour shifts and would probably fall right into bed as soon as she got home from the hospital. "Find yourself a nurse," he remembered his mother saying as they prepared for her act. "They always have jobs, and they like to take care of men." It was good advice, but even Sharon's patience had an end. Danny thought he'd almost reached it. He borrowed the 300 from her, told her he was done gambling. "Does that include poker?" she'd asked. It was a good question. Danny didn't think of poker as gambling. He learned to cold-read the rubes in his mother's mentalist act. His card-sharp father taught him to make the cards dance when the man was sober enough to hold a deck. Poker wasn't gambling. When you gambled, you might lose.
Danny knew all about losing. He was down 12 grand to Rod Renshaw due to a string of sporting misjudgments that climaxed when the Steelers had the bad grace to win the Super Bowl but lose the point spread. That was gambling. He'd lived high for the last few years thanks to ESPN's gambling coverage. It was beautiful. There were campuses full of trust fund kids who thought they knew how to play the game. Danny would hang out on campus. He looked young enough at 27 to pass for an undergraduate. He would make friends and get into games. It was like printing money. Then he met Sharon and made promises. Promises he wanted to keep. The poker craze had petered out anyway. He'd give up that life and get a job selling cars or something. At least I would have, he told himself, if it weren't for the Steelers and Rod Renshaw. Danny did not want to work for Rod. The man was cunning but stupid. He tried to get the same old college scam running, but the games weren't there anymore. So Rod would put Danny in a room full of very dangerous people and tell him to cheat. He'd lose Sharon for breaking his promises, and eventually Rod would get him killed. Danny stared down into his drink, searching for inspiration. He didn't find any. Maybe in the next round, or the one after that, he thought. Are you looking for a game? Danny glanced up at the mirror and almost laughed. The man who spoke looked like a Warner Brothers cartoon fox. He had a long, sharp nose and matching chin, but what really did it were the mutton chops. They were a rich, dark red and thrust out at least 4 inches from the man's thin jawline. Danny guessed him to be in his mid-50s. The clothes, a tan three-piece Harris tweed with matching hat, were eccentric but reeked of money. The last thing Danny noticed was the prosthetic hand. It seemed even more out of place than it should have given the rest of the picture. This guy should have been fitted with a brass hook. The fake paw looked shabby, like something you'd see for sale on the Penny Saver along with a walker and a bedside crapper. I was speaking to Mr. Strachany, and he tells me you are quite an accomplished card player? Danny glanced over at Jimmy, who nodded. My name is Alexander Crane. Danny Williams, when's this game? Tonight, Mr. Williams, Crane said. In just over an hour, in fact. There are usually 4 of us, but our Mr. Beaumont recently lost more than he could afford and has retired from playing. I must say, I've had a rather poor run myself lately. I'm hoping a bit of new blood may turn things around. High stakes? Danny asked. Indeed. Well, what's the buy-in? Danny held his breath. He had Sharon's 300, but in a real game they wouldn't let you take a seat without at least a grand. Oh, I can tell by looking at you that you're good for a debt. Shall we go then? My driver is parked across the street. This was bullshit. Danny looked at himself in the mirror. He did not look like money. He looked like a mugging victim in a decent suit. But Jimmy vetted the guy, and Danny was desperate. It was a game, and any game was a chance out of the mess he was in. Let's go. A black Lincoln pulled out to meet them as the two men stepped from the bar. The enormous driver, who held open the rear door, was dressed in an old-fashioned gray chauffeur uniform that made him look like a slab of granite. As they drove, Crane filled Danny in on the game. They played 5-card stud and English stud, dealer's choice, no wild cards. Limits? Danny asked. There are no limits. Crane had answered with no emotion, and Danny's face showed none as he heard the news. But his reservoir of hope rose a few feet. Wealthy players with no limit. $12,000 might be a stretch, but Danny was more than willing to stretch tonight. He glanced out the tinted windows and noticed the Lincoln had taken them deep into the Hill District. He watched small groups of young, hard-faced men gazing at the Lincoln with hungry eyes. Where's this game at? He asked. He'd expected one of the nicer hotels, maybe even the Duquesne Club. Any thought that they were taking a shortcut to some better part of town vanished as the Lincoln turned down a narrow alley and stopped. We're here, Crane said with a smile. They were parked in front of a battered-looking duplex with bars on the windows. Lights shone from the windows of one side. The other half was dark, but a small group of black teens sat on the steps in front of it smoking and laughing. You're kidding me, right? Danny said, watching a particularly tall youth shape his thumb and forefinger into a gun and point it at the Lincoln. The chauffeur got out and opened the rear door. We are going to get shot, Danny said. The older man slid out and walked briskly towards the teenagers. Danny followed him out of the car, but stood close to it in case he needed to get back inside in a hurry.
"Shit," said the tallest youth as the older man approached.
Crane began to speak. Danny couldn't hear what he said, but the youth's reactions, laughter, and curses echoed in the alleyway. But then, one by one, the boys grew silent. A fat teen in a Steelers jersey turned and walked away from the group. A moment later, two more joined him at a run. Finally, only the tallest one was left. Crane walked back to the Lincoln, and the teenager followed him. The boy was weeping.
"This young man has volunteered to watch our vehicle," Crane said.
The teenager stood at the end of the Lincoln and sniffed loudly.
"Shall we?" said Crane, and walked toward the lighted entrance.
Danny looked back at the teen, who had seemed so intimidating when the Lincoln first pulled up. The boy's wet eyes bore into Daniel's, trying to share something that couldn't be spoken. Danny looked away. This was why he'd fail Sharon. There was something very wrong happening here, and he was going to walk right into it. He pretended he was doing it for Sharon, so he could get out from under Rod and keep the promises he'd made to her. But that was just part of it. He wanted to read the marks' faces and make the cards dance. He could feel the tingle in his fingers. The location was wrong. The crying teenager was very wrong. But the tingle in his fingers was right. And that was what really mattered, more than Sharon or Rod. He had a game. Danny popped the joints in his neck, pushed his shoulders back, and walked up the steps. A wave of harshly scented air, bleach over decay, hit him as he crossed the threshold. He followed the granite back of the chauffeur down a short hall into what he guessed had once passed as a living room. Ghost shapes on the wall showed where a couch had once been, across from that a cheap entertainment center. Danny could still see the divots in the stained brown carpet. Now, the only furniture in the room was a scarred yellow formica table with matching chairs. The chauffeur pulled one of the chairs out for his boss and waited as Crane greeted the other men in the room. "Gentlemen, may I introduce Daniel Williams. He will be taking the place of Mr. Beaumont this evening." Crane took Danny's elbow and moved closer to the table where the two men sat. "Daniel, this is my good friend Nathaniel Lawden." Danny wasn't surprised at the crushing strength of Lawden's handshake. The man had the weathered look of someone who'd worked hard all his life and done well by it. Despite his Brooks Brothers suit, what Lawden looked like was a pirate. The man's hard features were set off by a bristling salt-and-pepper beard that came down to his chest, and his left eye was covered by a large black patch. "The gentleman to your right is Mr. Leo Nock." Nock looked like Colonel Sanders, if the colonel had been 100 pounds overweight and dyed his hair. Spiky tufts of dull gray hair that spilled from Nock's ears and nostrils ruined whatever effect the jet-black dye job was supposed to have. Danny found the man grotesque, except for his hands. Nock's hands were long and slender, more the hands of a beautiful woman than an obese old man. Danny shook one and nodded a wordless greeting.
"Last but not least is our handler of debt, Dr. Fitzhugh."
Danny hadn't noticed the man sitting in the fifth yellow chair. He was in the far corner of the room away from the table. As Crane named him, Fitzhugh hopped from the chair and approached Danny. He was no more than 5 feet tall and bald as a toad. Danny extended his hand, but Fitzhugh ignored it and began patting Danny down. He was both thorough and indelicate.
"Very fine player, I think," Fitzhugh said, once his prodding was done.
Without any more comment, he went back to his chair, picked up a metal box, and returned to the table. Fitzhugh opened the box, and Danny's heart stuttered. Inside the box were two unopened decks of playing cards. Beneath the cards were stacks of gold coins. Dr. Fitzhugh tossed the unopened decks in the center of the table and began stacking the gold coins in front of the men. His job done, he took the now empty box and returned to his seat in the corner. Danny sat down across from Lawden. The old pirate was grinning at him. The first coin he glanced at was old and had a large American eagle stamped on it. The second was older, and he thought the man on it was some sort of emperor. He hefted the golden emperor and felt the solid weight in his palm. What was something like this even worth? For all he knew, he could palm a few of these and not worry about the debt to Rod. The familiar sound of plastic coming off a new deck sounded to Danny's right. He looked up from the coin to see one of Mr. Knox's beautiful hands holding out the fresh deck.
"Shall we begin?" Mr. Knox asked.
Danny took the proffered deck and began to shuffle. You'd start straight. See what level these men were at. He needed to read them. See who sniffed or blinked when they drew a weak card, or maybe bit their lower lip when they bluffed. The pirate worried him. How do you read a man with only one eye and a beard covering half his face? As he rifled the deck, he noted a king of spades on the bottom. His mind automatically went into the routine of how to track that king and get it into his hand when he needed it.
How do they look from below, Mr. Williams? Boomed the pirate.
Danny's stomach lurched, but his hands continued shuffling and he glanced blankly towards the bearded man. The pirate smiled into Danny's blameless face.
I've just one eye, Mr. Williams, but it's a very good one.
Danny had never been caught cheating. He'd been accused a few times, but it was always sour grapes and not real suspicion. He had a routine for the occasion full of indignation and sarcasm. He didn't think it would work here. No one seemed angry or tense, not even the pirate. So Danny simply dealt the cards and played straight. He dealt, he wagered, and he watched the other players. They were good, but Danny was good too, even straight. And he'd been trained to read people by a professional. Danny glanced to his left where Crane studied his hand. Crane had no obvious tells, but he played like he had a lot to lose and could be bluffed. The pirate was just as hard to read as he'd feared. Moreover, he was a mumbler. He kept up a half-heard monologue, most of it directed at the cards in front of him. The mumbling annoyed Danny because he was sure it was an act and that the man was watching him like a hawk. He tested the assumption by moving an ace he saw on a cut from the bottom to the top of the deck and back again. As he did it, the pirate picked up a gold coin with Lady Liberty on it.
"Very prettily done," he said, holding up the coin, but looking pointedly at Danny.
Danny nodded and rifled the deck a few times. The fat man was Danny's salvation. He was a great technical player, but he had a tell. When he drew a card he liked, he would look from the card to Danny or Crane. When it was a card he didn't like, he looked first to the pirate. By itself, the tell was a great advantage. What made it golden was that the other two men hated the fat guy's guts. Danny saw it in their faces whenever Nock took a hand. When he realized that Crane and Lawton would rather lose to him than Mr. Nock, he knew he would finish the evening ahead. He hadn't been brought here by accident. He was a hired gun, and Nock was the target. The next hand, he bottom dealt Nock a broken straight. The pirate didn't blink. Danny spent the next 2 hours methodically taking Nock apart. 1 hour into the job, Danny could smell the fat man's sweat. By 3 a.m., half of Nock's coins had been redistributed to the other three men. As he lost another hand, Nock closed his eyes and groaned.
I'm finished, he said.
The pirate looked at Nock with feigned surprise.
It's early yet, Leo. Are you sure you want to square up now? Your luck could turn.
You'd like me to go all out, wouldn't you, you bastard?
I'd like nothing better, fat man, the pirate said with a grim smile.
Before things could get more tense, Dr. Fitzhugh approached the table. The game is over, gentlemen. Are we ready to resolve debts, then?
Yes, Nock and Crane said.
You're damned right, yes, Lawton hissed.
He pushed himself out of his chair and walked toward the door in the rear of the room. The other men followed at a slower pace, except for Dr. Fitzhugh, who was looking at Danny.
Are you ready to resolve debts?
Sure, Danny answered. What about the coins?
If you'll just follow the other gentlemen, sir, Dr. Fitzhugh said, gesturing to the door, all debts will be resolved now.
Danny stood and walked toward the door. He didn't want to go through it. The elation he felt at tearing apart Nock was gone. He had a bad feeling. He felt it in his fingers, and his fingers did not lie.
Don't worry, Mr. Williams. The debts tonight are in your favor, Fitzhugh said, as if reassuring a child.
Danny stepped through the door into a small kitchen. There were two large wooden chairs in the center of the room with a plastic TV tray between them. Mr. Nock sat in one of the chairs. His black hair stood out starkly against his sickly pale skin. The pirate sat on the other. He was half turned in his seat to face the fat man, and he was laughing. Fitzhugh pushed past Danny to the two men. He set a leather case on the tray.
You are ready, Mr. Nock?
He's ready, laughed the pirate. You know what I want, don't you, fat man? I think I'll have the left one.
Decorum, Mr. Lawton, admonished Dr. Fitzhugh.
Let him have his fun, Knox said, standing from the chair. He unbuttoned his suit jacket, tossed it to the floor, and removed his shirt and pants. Danny took a step back. Beneath his suit, Knox was wearing a white mesh step-in, like something out of an old Sears and Roebuck catalog. Beneath the mesh, he was writhing. Knox unbuttoned the shoulder straps of his undergarment and let it fall away. He looked at Lawton as he did so. You're small time, Lawton, and someday I'll own you. Danny gagged. Knox wasn't fat. The man's body was festooned with limbs. A third arm hung down from one armpit. A line of hands were sewn from his sternum to his groin. No two the same size or skin tone. There were other things, numerous ears, assorted fingers. A patch of long pink tongues hung in concentric circles from his left breast. Eyes, a dozen at least, rose like pustules on his right. The man was a forest of borrowed flesh, and it was alive. The hands stroked the flesh around them. The tongues lashed the air. The third arm bent, and its hand pointed to the rash of blinking eyes. Take your pick. I have, and it will be the left one, Beaumont's. Lawton was smiling with malice as he spoke, but Danny could tell the man was envious. Dr. Fitzhugh offered a tightly rolled piece of leather to Knock. I'll think of this as a loan, he sneered at Lawton, and bit down on the leather. Nausea rolled over Danny as the scalpel bit into Knox's face just below his left eye. It wasn't until Fitzhugh pushed his thumb into the incision and began working the eye loose that Danny fell to the ground and retched. When he looked up, Crane was kneeling between him and the grisly scene. He could still hear Knox's harsh grunts. I think Mr. Williams should collect next, Crane said. This is all a bit new to him. Crane had removed his prosthetic hand and rolled his sleeve up to expose the stump. Danny stood as soon as his gut allowed. He kept his eyes locked on Crane and ignored the sounds from the chairs. I think I'll take my winnings in cash, he said, in a voice that attempted confidence. No, you won't. You will collect your debt. There are rules to this thing, and they will be kept. You didn't tell me the rules, Danny hissed. No, but you're in good and proper now, and you will abide by them. Danny closed his eyes as a particularly harsh grunt coupled with a wet, ripping sound issued from the chairs. But he didn't try to leave, and when Dr. Fitzhugh called his name, he shambled forward and sat in the chair that Lawton now stood beside. Lawton whispered in Danny's ear, Just relax, boy. First time's always the hardest. He's not so piratical now that he has two eyes, Danny thought. The new eye was hazed with blood. Black sutures, like flies' legs, bristled around the socket. Beaumont's, Lawton had said. Danny's mind flicked back to his first conversation with Crane. Beaumont lost more than he could afford. He glanced at Knock. The top of the man's thigh bristled with fingers. Danny wondered how much of Beaumont hung from Knock's body. Someone said his name from far away. I'm in shock, Danny said, not sure if he spoke aloud or not. I'll choose for him, said Lawton. Give him the hand. I saw him admiring it. Danny heard his name again, and he thought he might be nodding. For what seemed like hours, he watched with fascination as a red flower of blood grew and blossomed in the white gauze taped where Knox's left eye had been. Put the leather in his mouth when he screams, Dr. Fitzhugh said. Daniel watched the doctor turn in slow motion. He wanted to explain that it didn't matter. Danny has left the building, Doc. He's watching things from way up on Mount Washington. You can do your worst. He's not coming back. Danny looked on impassively as Dr. Fitzhugh pressed what looked like chrome pruning shears against the flesh of his armpit. Somebody took my shirt, Danny thought. Lousy trick. Take a man's shirt when he isn't around to argue the point? Pain exploded and a scream filled the kitchen for the half a second it took Lawton to jam in the leather. Danny was back, and the pain was blinding and gigantic and every sharp-toothed thing. Behind the leather, he kept screaming.
But I won! But I won! But I won!
He was in the Lincoln, and the pain was gone. Danny savored that for a while. When he opened his eyes again, he saw Dr. Fitzhugh. "Back with us, Mr. Williams?" Danny blinked his eyes. The pain wasn't gone. It's just a different sort of animal now. Annoying, not deadly. And there was something else. Another feeling that he didn't try to examine yet. "Where are we?" Danny asked. It came out cracked, so he swallowed and asked again. "Downtown. I didn't know where you wanted to go." Danny looked out the window and saw the mirrored walls of PPG Plaza. He felt something throb in his armpit and tried not to think about it. "What time is it?" 2 in the afternoon. "Just get me to the incline. I'll take it from there." Fitzhugh spoke to the chauffeur, and the two men rode in silence as the Lincoln headed towards Station Square. Fitzhugh held out an open palm toward Danny. On it were 4 of the gold coins they had played with the night before.
What happened last night?" Danny asked, not reaching for the gold.
"You won," said Fitzhugh. He leaned forward and spilled the coins down into Danny's shirt. Something caught them. "The next game is on Friday. Be at Drake's at 9. Mr. Knox says he wants a chance to win his own back." The Lincoln stopped as Fitzhugh finished speaking. Danny didn't reply. He got out of the car and headed toward the incline without looking back. The incline stuttered its way up the side of Mount Washington. Danny watched the city and thought. He took a deep breath, reached beneath his shirt, and touched a stranger's long, delicate fingers. His mind registered a sensation from the new flesh. He felt the round solidness of the coins it held. He pressed his thumbnail into the new hand and felt pain. The sensations weren't confusing. Danny had a third hand growing from his left armpit, and if he had to say how it felt, the only word that came to mind was natural. He let out a brittle chuckle. A few hours before, he'd been worried about losing his girlfriend and being owned by a murderous thug. "Those were the days," he said into the incline's empty compartment. He flexed the fingers on his third hand and felt the coins spill down his torso and catch where his shirt tucked into his trousers. He took the coins out and looked at them. A spasm of panic made him flinch. The incline reached the top. Danny pushed his way through a group of camera-toting tourists eager to get on. He needed to get control, but he didn't know how. He thought of Knox's writhing torso, and the memory hunched him over like a gut punch. Life had always been like poker for Danny. The cards might go against him for a while, but then he'd spot that ace on the cut, and he'd be back in control. The Rod Renshaw situation was bad, but he would have seen his chance eventually. He'd had no chance with Crane since the moment he'd agreed to the game. He'd been used as a weapon against Knock, and now that Crane and Lawton had their fun, the three of them would pick Danny apart. Another game on Friday. Mr. Knock wanted a chance to win his own back. Danny closed his eyes and tried to rub the images away. All that flesh Knock wagered, it wasn't his own. Through closed eyes, he saw the tentacle-like tongues sprouting from Knock's chest. The man was playing with other people's property. Danny's eyes opened. He still felt shaky, but he thought, just maybe, he'd caught a glimpse of that ace. Losing wasn't so bad when you played with other people's money. Danny looked at himself in the gold-flecked mirror of Drake's Bar and Grill. His lip was just about healed, and the mark on his cheek had disappeared altogether. The slender, lovely hand that now grew from his left armpit made a slight bulge beneath his jacket. The kind of bulge a thug might mistake for a gun. Rod did, the night Danny met with him. He took one look at Danny's sport coat and opened his own to display a pearl-handled Smith & Wesson. Instead of a pistol, Danny pulled out a thick roll of $100 bills. He had gotten $15,000 for the coins. It would have been more if he'd been willing to wait for the dealer to run a theft check on them, but it was enough. Rod pretended to be happy to get his money back, but Danny could see disappointment in the set of his jaw. He didn't want his $12,000, he wanted Danny. So when Danny asked him for the $12,000 back, plus 8 more on top, he didn't just laugh and throw him out. He listened to the angle. How there was a chance to take down some wealthy gamblers, and Danny just needed the $20,000 for sit-down money? Rod wasn't smart, but he was cunning. In the end, he was too cunning to let Danny just walk away with $20,000 of his hard-earned dollars. Danny watched as Alexander Crane moved through Drake's Friday night crowd toward him.
The hand Crane extended was olive-skinned, manicured, and wasn't there last week. He stood, but it was Rod who shook Crane's new appendage.
Rod Renshaw, it's nice to meet you.
Crane's eyes questioned Danny.
Danny told me there were some worries about him getting a seat in the game tonight, said Rod. No worries, I'm backing him.
Crane looked from Danny to Rod, and now there was a smile playing on his lips.
Are you saying you will be responsible for Mr. Williams' debts?
Yeah, I'll bank him. I'm good for it.
I'm sure you are, Mr. Renshaw.
You'll excuse me, I need to phone my associates.
You do that, Rod said with his usual bluster, and turned back to his half-finished gimlet.
Danny downed the remnants of his own drink in one nervous gulp. He knew he couldn't just walk away from the strange games that Crane had drawn him into. Danny recalled the words of Mr. Nock.
You'd like me to go all out, wouldn't you?
That was the only way. Like Beaumont, Danny had to lose more than he could afford. But losing isn't all that bad if you're playing with other people's money.
Crane approached them again. It's unusual, but the other players have agreed.
Danny thought Crane's face looked hungry as he spoke.
Of course, I'm coming along, Rod said, sliding from his bar stool. Got to watch out for my investment, right?
Most assuredly, Mr. Renshaw. In fact, we insist. Danny followed the two men out of the bar. Crane now had his hand on Rod's arm like a farmer with his prize pig. Plan could go wrong, Danny thought. In the strange, not-so-according-to-Hoyle world he found himself in, Rod Smith and Wesson might still always beat Surgical Steel, no matter what dark power wielded it. It was too late to worry. It was time to read the faces and make the cards dance. The Lincoln pulled up as the three men stepped to the curb. Danny could feel the tingling in his fingers, all 15 of them. He had a game.
The thing about acceptance is it's failure. You accept that you'll always be the weight you are. You accept that you'll never get over whatever it is you're addicted to. You accept that you do not deserve to be happy. That the world does not, in fact, owe you a cookie. That any given series finale will disappoint. Because, I mean, it should work, but it never does, right? You accept the possibility of failure, and in doing so, you accept that failure is embodied in everyone and everything, including you. You're not alone. The thing about fighting is, it's hard. You fight to lose weight, you fight to get over your addiction, you fight to get the acceptance from your life that you richly deserve, and you fight to believe that that series finale is good, that your first instinct was right, that everything does hold together. You fight for respect, you fight for health, you fight to not let your opinions be swayed by the majority, to stand above everyone else and say, I'm here. This is me. It's never easy, it's frequently pointless, and you are, it seems, always alone. But that's false, because we all fight. Every single one of us pushing back against life, hammering a maker's mark into the hull of the world and leaving things just a little different, because if we can manage that, that's a kind of immortality, and the call of that immortality is enough to get each and every one of us to stick when we should twist, bet when we should fold, stand up when everyone else is telling us to stay down. There's horror there, certainly, and in the hands of a lesser author, that's all there would be. But this is Frank, and Frank shows us the bravery, too. The bravery that's as admirable as it is utterly, utterly chilling. This is horror as the dark mirror held up to us and showing us ourselves in our terrifying, flawed, pathetic, magnificent glory. In apprehension, how like a god, or perhaps more appropriately, how like someone with a really great hand. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Pseudopod exists solely due to the need for there to be a dark side of the street and is only able to do that because of you and your generosity. Please consider donating, and if you want to, click on Feed the Pod on pseudopod.org. That's the only place the money will go directly to us. Regardless, Pseudopod knows that what we do in life echoes in eternity.